Welcome to the More Equity Podcast by Harlem Capital. Harlem Capital is a diversity-focused early-stage venture capital firm based in New York City. We're on a mission to invest in 1,000 diverse founders over the next 20 years. This season, managing partners Henri Pierre-Jacques and Jared Tingle sit down with Harlem Capital's limited partners, the investors who help bring the firm to life. Tune in as we share stories and insights on navigating the VC fundraising landscape, from pitching fund strategy to building relationships with LPs and successfully raising capital. In today's episode, we speak with David Gilmore, Deputy Chief Investment Officer at the Harry and Jeanette Weinberg Foundation. David shares with listeners how institutions think through asset allocation and manager selection, based on his current role and prior experience at the Ohio State University Investment Office. Tune in as Henri and David discuss everything from the risks the foundation saw in Harlem Capital before deciding to invest, to how emerging managers can best convey their firm vision to institutional LPs.
All right, David, thanks for joining us here today. I want to start with a brief bio so people kind of have a sense and you can kind of fill in any of the stuff that I left out. So David joined the Harry and Jeanette Weinberg Foundation in 2014 to help build the foundation's first investment office. The Harry and Jeanette Weinberg Foundation is one of the largest private charitable foundations in the United States. Its purpose is to assist low-income and vulnerable individuals and families through nonprofit grants across 7 areas of giving. The Weinberg Foundation, to my latest knowledge, has $3.2 billion of assets under management and over $130 million of grants each year. David is the CIO for the foundation, and we'd love to hear anything else that you have from a personal perspective that would be great for us to know that we couldn't find on the website.
it's been great. And the foundation has seen a lot of growth. Even since I've joined, and a lot of change since I've joined. You're absolutely right. We've got $3.2 billion. We're giving away a little over $130 million and probably a little more next year, which is great. And part of that is, you know, the investments and the portfolio have done well, and Harlem is a part of that that story. So we're really excited about that. A little bit of background about the foundation is Harry Weinberg really made a lot of wealth from real estate. And so the foundation of the $3.2 billion, about $1 billion is still in real estate, direct real estate holdings. We have 2 offices, one right outside of Baltimore in Owings Mills, and also one in Honolulu, Hawaii. And a lot of people ask us, why do we have a Hawaii office? Well, part of it is Harry owns a lot of did own a lot of real estate in Hawaii. And so that's the legacy of that office. And now we also make quite a few grants in Hawaii. And we, as a part of the investment team, we have 5 individuals that really focus on the real estate portfolio, and they're based in Hawaii. So in total, we have about 10 investment professionals, both focused on the real estate and then everything else but real estate. The non-real estate professionals are all located in Baltimore.
Nice. And to my knowledge, before Weinberg, you were the CIO of Ohio State, right?
I was, Jonathan Hook and I both came over from Ohio State to work together. So John was, when John was brought into Ohio State to really build a dedicated office back in 2008, right before the crash. So it was an interesting timing from John's perspective. He gave me a call, asked me if I would be interested in leaving a consulting fund-to-funds group out of Memphis, Tennessee called Gerber Taylor to really join him and help build that investment office. And so that's how I ended up at Ohio State working with John. The foundation reached out and really wanted to build an internal team before John and I came over to help build that office or build the office here at Weinberg. They had several outsource providers. So they actually chose to go the opposite direction and insource it and build a dedicated team focused on really building out the portfolio and bringing all the assets back in-house. When John left Ohio State, I was the interim CIO for a little while. It made John chase me a little bit before I left to join the foundation. But it was an interesting opportunity to really start. It was a startup. You can think of the foundation's investment office as a startup. We ended up switching custodians, building out internal you know, governance, software, anything that really touches an investment office, we had to build it. So it was an interesting experience, a lot more work than I was expecting, believe it or not, but it's been fun.
Always
is. Watching it. Yeah, watching it, you know, and just looking back now, seeing all the growth and how much capital, you know, how much the portfolio has grown and how much more money we can give away as an organization is really rewarding. And part of the reason why I joined, because it's one way I can have an impact individually and really help people. When I first joined, we were giving away, I think it was around $93 or $94 million in grants. And so this year, I think we're going to, starting in 2022, I think we're going to be closer to $140 million. So awesome. it's a great feeling to be a part of the team, and we play a small role, but there's you know, 55 or so employees that are really working hard to give it away in a way that really impacts people's lives, and so it's great to be a part of the team.
And what's the, I mean, the Ohio State Endowment side, Weinberg Foundation side, like any difference that you've seen from a strategy perspective in terms of like how you guys allocate capital, like just give people some perspective?
Yeah, I guess, you know, from Ohio State days, I left, they had about $3.5 billion. So it was not too different than where we are today, maybe a little bit bigger. From a strategy standpoint, we were not as active on venture. That was one thing that we were not active as. We
were most weren't in 2008.
Well, you know, what's funny is like there was a 10-year period early in my career where venture really was pretty awful, you know, and energy was all, you know, all these other asset classes really did perform very well. And you know, looking back the last 10 years, probably most people in the industry would laugh at that statement, but there was a period where venture was not very interesting for a lot of people. And not to say that we weren't interested, it's just, there was no legacy. When we took over the portfolio from Ohio State, they had no legacy investments in venture, few connections, not a whole lot of the alumni base was based in Silicon Valley. You know, there wasn't a natural competitive advantage from an investment office perspective. And so it's just an area we did not have a lot of exposure to.
Yep, makes sense. And so I guess, did you see any difference in, like, regardless of venture, just determining managers, any difference in determining managers from a foundation versus endowment perspective are relatively the same?
As far as the type of managers we would hire?
Yeah, or like just like the process or the things that you guys would look for why you would invest in those managers.
The process the two senior people from that office joined this office. Yep. The process was pretty similar. I will say we've always really had a pretty flexible approach in how we evaluate kind of early stage managers. So that was consistent from moving from Ohio State to here. We've been early day one, fund one. We've tried not to have a lot of absolutes as far as what we won't invest in. It helps us kind of keep an open mind as we're looking at different strategies and different partners to bring into the portfolio. And that's one thing that I think has been consistent over time. You know, a lot of it has to do with governance as well. And so each institution has a kind of a different governance model. We had discretion at Ohio State, and we are fortunate that the trustees and the board here really have given us a lot of flexibility and have confidence, you know, in our ability to really execute in a flexible governance model and asset allocation model. And so, you know, those things were attractive to come over to the foundation and work under that model.
Yep. And I guess from a high level perspective for Weinberg Foundation, give the audience like a general sense of, you know, what do you look for in managers? What's your typical kind of like check size for your first investment? And then are there like any hard no's that like you have in your investment criteria?
we try. Though I know you like too to be many flexible. Hard no's. Hey, look, it's a, you know, I think with each asset class, it's probably a little different as far as sizing. Yep. So with venture, it's probably we're probably in the 5 to 10 range. PE is a little bit bigger, maybe 10 to 20, depending on what the strategy is. Growth equity or somewhere in between there. We do have the ability to do direct investing. So we've done some direct investing within the portfolio. Normally that's partnering with someone that we've already invested with. They have something that they think is really interesting and they bring it to us. We've done a few outside of existing partners in the portfolio. As we get more liquid, the sizing goes up. So and really one lesson, and I should have mentioned, maybe one lesson learned from Ohio State days and also looking at a lot of endowments at the time, is that I think we ended up being a little too diversified. So we had too many strategies, too many partners. And so one thing we did take away from that experience and something that we've implemented here is we are trying to concentrate more dollars in fewer relationships. And that it has some positives, but you know, a few negatives. Positives are, you know, we can get deeper and have a closer relationship and build, you know, stronger positions with each of our partners that we invest with and over multiple funds, hopefully, especially on the private side. The negative is, you know, there's just not that many slots once we have the portfolio built out. And when I say slots, it's just a matter of, you know, there's the other goal that kind of that also informs that sentence or that philosophy is, we want to maintain a pretty small and efficient team. So we're not trying to build a huge investment office. So the only way that I feel like, and John and the rest of the team, we feel like that we can really get to know our managers is we've got to put a cap on, you know, how many of those relationships can we manage, plus still source interesting things on a global basis. And so it's really challenging. You know, I think we use technology. We try to be efficient in our time. There's a lot of things we try to do to increase our bandwidth and our flexibility from an investment office standpoint. But we are trying to keep our head count as far as the number of relationships we have in a fairly concentrated portfolio of partners. And we feel like that's been part of, we think that's going to be a recipe for success going forward within the portfolio.
Yeah, I feel that's where the industry is going. And one thing that we underappreciated was like, there's only a certain number of new managers on an annual basis. And so a question we always ask LPs when we start is, how many new managers do you do a year? Because that's really important for summer one, summer zero.
That is a good question. You know, our answer would have been a lot different the first time we had our conversation, if you would have asked us that question, because we were still in the building phase.
Yep.
So the foundation didn't have any really venture or private equity before we got here in 2014. The first couple of years, we were building and making changes to the more liquid strategy or liquid parts of the asset allocation. And then, you know, about a year and a half or 2 years into it, we really shifted our focus and now we're probably more like 80-20. We're 80% of the time focused on kind of private opportunities across the spectrum versus the public opportunities. But in those early years, John and I, Jonathan Hook and I, the John's our CIO, currently I'm deputy CIO. John, you know, we would joke that we were both working on a memo every month, right? Investment. We were doing two memos like every month for almost 2.5 years. I mean, it was a little crazy. And part of it was, you know, we had a lot of previous relationships. We had our networks. We had some managers that came with us, some managers we already knew and have done, you know, so there's lots of reasons we could operate at that pace. And plus we added Jeff and Brian to the team. And that really propelled us to maintain that speed. But, you know, a lot of those early decisions, you know, hopefully our hit rate is going to be pretty high, and it has been. And so we haven't had a lot of change from those early decisions at this point. But last year, let's just use this year. We've only hired 8 new managers this year.
Yeah.
So
which is a decent amount compared
that's still
to what
probably
I've seen
a little others. High, right? I would not expect us to hire that many new partners next year. Let's just, you know, I think that's a high number. But you know, we're probably on the very tail end of that build stage and we're now entering more of a stabilized portfolio. A new manager would have to probably replace an existing somewhere in the portfolio. So we're much more at a stabilized kind of headcount. Last year or this year was a little, we were really busy at the beginning of the year. There was a lot of interesting and kind of,
I feel like people were overpaced on all levels in 2021.
You know, and maybe part of that was, you know, we were a little bit slower due to COVID, kind of knocked us out for a few months. But, you know, what we have seen, and you know, one thing we had talked about offline was just, you know, pacing, like, what are we seeing in the market? And it's been unusually fast having managers come back to market. And partly that's just the environment we're in, and we're seeing some great opportunities, and there's a lot of interesting investments for our partners to invest with. So the reason I say next year is probably going to be a lot slower is because we anticipate having a lot of our existing partners coming back to market, and we will be, you know, doing our due diligence and underwriting on those funds. I'm sure the first quarter will be a lot slower from a new partner perspective.
Yeah. I mean, when we were fundraising, we found that to be kind of shocking because we realized, like, oh, well, one, managers are coming back to market faster. And so people are re-upping. And so the LPs don't have the capital because they're given to their existing managers. But then two, you know, last year saw massive increases in public exits for companies. And so a lot of LPs, curious what your guys' allocation is, but for a lot of LPs, for the listeners, they typically have like 10, 20, 30% venture target allocations. And because their VC firms were getting public stock, like their allocations were 40, 50, 60%. And so they were over allocated venture. Their managers are coming back to market faster. And so essentially they were, you know, a lot of LPs were telling us like, hey, we're not doing any new managers just because we're way over allocated. I think a lot of emerging managers don't understand kind of how this asset allocation works and why LPs won't invest you or can't invest you because of, you know, these requirements that they have.
I will say even this year, there's been three or four I would have loved to invest with. I really enjoyed the conversation. Strong, you know, really strong team. Strategy was really interesting. But what you just described is happening everywhere. Our allocations on the private side are way up, almost to the point where we're a little, it's a great problem to have. So, you know, it sounds like I'm complaining. I'm not complaining, but it does impact our ability to deploy new capital to new strategies and partners and really think about, because, you know, the last thing I want to do is to cut back on my existing partners and firms like Harlem when they're very doing great, you know, having some great outcomes in the portfolios. And, you know, so first and foremost, we're going to fund our partners to the fullest we can and hopefully increase that over time. And then, you know, as time goes on, hopefully we can find some room. But it is a challenge. You know, when we first started allocating, we had our budget, you know, it was a beautiful budget. You know, we are always over budget by a little bit, which is fine. You know, but, you know, looking back on it, it is the allocations have grown in size to the point where it's even surprised me. And, you know, you can tell I've been in the industry for a little while. It's, you know, it's been a little surprising. It's a great problem to have, but it does limit us in other parts of how we manage the portfolio.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I think you guys do you have a diverse manager program?
You know, we do. It's more of a goal. You know, we wanted to increase, it started back in 2018. So at the board level and the investment office, we had a lot of conversations, you know, and that effort really got kicked off in 2018. And we talked to a lot of different groups like the Kretzky Foundation and Kellogg and all these different groups who were quite honestly ahead of us in their efforts. And so we wanted to learn what they were doing, how they were thinking about it. It was important to the foundation to really grow diversity within our investment portfolio. You know, the people we're serving are very diverse. Our organization is diverse. And so it became a priority for us. And so our goal was to try to get, and this is more manager count, try to get 25% of our managers to have majority diverse ownership. And this coincides with kind of the recent Knight Foundation study that came out. And if anyone's listening, you can Google it and find it and look and see kind of where a lot of the foundations are at this point, and see the Weinberg Foundation as well. We're going to finish the year with about 28% of our managers with majority diverse ownership. So it's something that we've worked hard on the last couple of years. The entire team, it's a part of our general research practice, and it's incorporated in everything we do. It's not a side portfolio or one person's dedicated to it. We're all working on it, and it's something we've all worked on. And you know, I told you we had 8 managers this year. 7 of those were diverse hires. So
that's great. No, I think about that a lot, because like as LPs get more and more concentrated portfolios, less new managers, I think inadvertently it's going to be harder to diversify the GP landscape. And so that's something I always push LPs on. It's like, okay, if you want to concentrate within, you know, how do you get new emerging managers who are diverse, you know, one below your typical check size and getting new slots? I think that's a challenge a lot of people have when they're trying to kind of create concentrated portfolios.
It is. The one thing that we think about as well is, you know, it also, those teams as they grow tend to be more diverse, right? It's a way to the whole industry can really move forward and improve kind of a lot of the statistics that your team has been generating with your research as far as deploying capital. But you're absolutely right. Like, you know, having a concentrated portfolio doesn't necessarily help on the other front as far as trying to get more capital out. Some ways that we think we can help is connecting other institutions with maybe managers that we won't be able to include, but we really like and think the strategy is interesting. You know, we can make those kind of connections. We can act as references for our existing partners. So we're trying to be active within the community to try to grow all of the ENFs as they're trying to go down this path. And we were just a little bit ahead, I think, of some, but we definitely weren't at the forefront. And now we're just trying to help others as they go down this path. And everybody really has different goals, different ways to look at it. You know, even the Knight Foundation study that came out, you know, different people view this topic as far as setting goals differently. We picked majority ownership as just the one that we would focus on. And that's where we ended up.
No, makes sense. I like it. And switching gears, I guess, to more of like building the relationship, and we can kind of use Harlem Capital as an example. So thinking back to our beginning of relationship, I remember it pretty vividly when I came to Baltimore.
Do I want to hear this? Do I want to hear the unfiltered truth?
I'll share my perspective. I'm curious to hear, you know, from your, I'll share mine after you to let you go first. But how did you hear about Harlem Capital? And what was like the first things that, you know, went through your process? And I can share my perspective on the flip side.
Okay. No, happy to do that. So, you know, I think I first heard Harlem's name and I actually printed it off. It's it was from the Wall Street Journal when it was KKR partners with Harlem Capital and enhanced diversity. Yep. And that article was written, I think, in May of 2019. And so the first quarter of 2019 is really when this was our main goal, our project to really ramp up our sourcing and networking. And at the time, you know, there wasn't as many conferences, and it's wonderful to see the growth of just knowledge and access and seeing all the new firms being formed and other firms being recognized for being there all along, but just never got the exposure. And so that was really the first time I think I've read. And then once I ran across that article in the Wall Street Journal, I started stalking you on social media, and you guys were pretty prolific at the time. I say stalking, I didn't mean it in a negative way, but you know, I do like my Twitter. I do like, you know, other.
I do see you liking stuff.
You mentioned that. So anyway, you know, it's a new medium, and I was really impressed with how you guys were using it. To be honest, you know, I think it was underutilized by most investment firms as far as building brand awareness at an early stage. And I thought you guys did an excellent job with building kind of your brand and building awareness of what you were trying to do and your mission to really fund minority and women founders over time. And so I think from that email, I believe someone else mentioned your name to me in a call.
Yeah, Paula,
you know, so
Paula
I kind of triangulated. Yeah, I believe the first contact I made was I sent you a cold email, just to get more information. And so I believe that's the first time we talked. And then I think our first meeting was July 1st of 2019.
Yeah. July, and I came to Baltimore in August, the Wednesday after Jared had his daughter was born. So I remember that train ride. and I think for the listeners, not all LPs saw the media as a strength. So we definitely had pushback on that as well. Like, are you staying focused? Is it too much of a distraction? And so I think, you know, for a lot of GPs, you have to kind of make a decision on what your strategy is going to be, and you have to kind of put your foot in the ground. And some of those LPs didn't invest, some did, and kind of eventually realized the power of media. And obviously now I think a lot of firms are taking towards this, particularly like in the solo GP movement. But it wasn't, you know, 2-3 years ago, it wasn't like media was the strategy that LPs were all on board with. Yeah, so I remember you reaching out. So Paula Pretler was on the board of the Weinberg Foundation. To the social media point, she DM'd me on LinkedIn because she's a Northwestern alum and I went to Northwestern. And she had mentioned that Weinberg was looking to diversify the manager. And she's like, hey, I've seen the work you're doing. I would love to put you in touch and get you connected. And so it definitely helps to have a sponsor on your side. I've told a lot of emerging managers this, to have somebody who's on the board or the CIO, et cetera. But I remember, I mean, you guys were probably the fastest conviction. Like, we had one call in July, maybe two max. And I came to Baltimore for an hour and a half meeting. That was a Wednesday. And then Friday, you called me and said, hey, we're largely there. Like, assuming that we get through kind of like the normal diligence process. Like, that's so rare for LPs. Like, what enabled you guys to have such a high conviction, fast process decision? Because I was thoroughly impressed. And to this day, it's probably the fastest we've gotten a decision from the institution.
Now everyone's going to expect that.
It doesn't happen for all processes, but like, I just found it. I mean, we've evolved too, right? Like, we did our fastest deal. It was 48 hours, which is not true for a lot of our deals, but like, we can do it if we have to. Right. And so I think it's like, what, like, there are moments that kind of lead to us making these decisions. And so I'm just curious, like, from your guys' perspective, like, what enables that? And then, you know, taking a step back, like, what is the typical process for you guys, like, in length of time?
Yeah, I just want to point out that we did put a little caveat in there, pending.
You put, you know, the caveat. Further due diligence. I remember.
So can I state that for the record to make sure that, you know, we get that in there? No, hey, look, it's with any fund one, and I think at the time you were trying to raise $26
million. Yeah, 25.
25 or something. So to be honest, your fund was kind of too small, right? I mean, it just really was, right, for us to move the needle when you think about it in those terms, right?
Yep.
And what we really focused on was where we thought you would be in 2 or 3 years. Clearly, I don't think you had a lot of realizations at that point. You guys were on fund one, small fund. Hopefully you won't take this the wrong way. You probably had a lot of lessons still to learn. And that was part of the underwriting for us. I hopefully I'm not hurting your feelings too much, but look, there's a great quote, like, invest like an optimist, worry about everything. You know, in some ways, I really felt like if you were able to accomplish 80% of what you were pitching, as far as not only from the fund performance, but also your research, the internship programs, the fellowships, building your team. You know, I don't know if you remember, but we asked you a lot of questions about, well, where do you see this firm 3 or 4 years down the road? And
yep.
The vision was an important part of that conversation. We had tried to do a lot of work ahead of our meeting to get there. And just the mission and where you were focused. We thought we could generate really attractive returns and also have an impact. And at the time, you know, there weren't as many opportunities like that for us, where we had conviction. We already liked early stage managers and the hunger factor and the drive. And so all of those things kind of align for us. We wanted to go as big as we possibly could with you and then grow with you from an allocation standpoint. And so that's really kind of where we approached this. We wanted to partner with you as you grew and as your impact expanded. And you know, fast forward to where we are today, I think a lot of the things I was looking at our old investment, it's always fun to go back. That's why we write them.
I would love to see that at some point.
No. Top secret. No disclosures. But anyway, you know, a lot of the things that we thought had a high potential to play out has really come to fruition. And that's it's easy to look at historical returns and track records, and everybody can do that, right? I mean, the numbers are everywhere. The hard part is trying to figure out where people are going to end up, you know, 2 or 3 years down the road. What kind of teams are they going to build? What kind of practice, you know, how are they going to put it all together? Can they lead people effectively? We felt you guys could do that. We weren't quite sure, you know, what the final product would be. And that's still probably an evolution, right? Yep. You're still growing, right? It's still very early in your firm's development. And it's really enjoyable to watch as you grow and watch kind of how your success has been recognized by the market and through commitments and other things from other LPs. But that's, you know, as we were thinking about you and Jared and the firm and your other partners and where we think you could be, and if you achieve that, we wanted to be a part of it. And so that's kind of how we came to that decision. Now, look, we put a whole list of risk in there.
Yep.
You know,
that was literally my next point.
A track record. I'll be happy to run through them. No track record. You know, I believe you were investing across a lot of different asset classes early in your life of
the angel syndicate. Yeah.
Yeah. You're doing a lot of different things, right? And you kind of hit your groove, right? You hit your strategy, you got your focus. You know, we also were wondering, were you stretching yourself too thin, right? I mean, you were everywhere, right? Once I started tracking you, I was like, oh my gosh, they're doing everything. And look, but that was part of the attraction for us as well, because the people you wanted to invest with and find have been overlooked. So how do you actually make those connections if you're going to do it the same way that all the other venture firms were going to do it? So building your brand and trying to get up, you know, out of kind of the general crowd was really important. And so, you know, that is what set you guys apart, as far as you had a very focused mission. You could communicate it well. I thought your process was excellent. You know, you took us through kind of all of the things that would lead to an investment. How do you get there? How do you evaluate it? What were all the steps? You know, the process doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a great investment, but it's really interesting because as you talk through your process, and I realize it you know, you'll change it 100 times probably. Right. Yeah. I mean, it changes, right? Which is great. But that is important, right? But it's important to try to hammer down process. And you guys were really focused on a lot of things early that I think some firms are just trying to raise money and then they're going to figure it out. Whereas I felt like you guys had really thought through. And that was the other thing that was an attractive part of the story for us, was just you had a lot of really strong partners along the way to help push your firm forward, as far as, you know, TPG or Techstars or KKR. And so I felt like there was a lot of support there. Whenever the inevitable mistakes or you need a sounding board, or, you know, I can help you as an LP, but having others in your field and in the industry there to be able to help support kind of whatever is needed, I also thought was a positive along the way. So those are a few of my thoughts. Hopefully,
I think that's helpful. And you know, similar for us. So when we invest in founders, we share our memos with other VC firms when we lead a deal to get them on board. I think oftentimes, I remember an investor 2 weeks ago was like, "Wow, like there was a lot of risk you had in the memo, and you still made that investment, right?" And I think part of it, and when we share the memos with the founders, is like, just because we invest doesn't mean we don't think there are problems, right? Like, I think ultimately we thought that the reward outweighed the risk. And, you know, some of the things, just so our listeners can kind of hear on the positive side, right? Partnerships, having processes in place, brand, what's your vision? And I often tell managers this, when you're trying to get institutions, they're trying to assess whether or not you can build a platform, right? So are you going to be around for 3 to 5 funds and then put in real capital? It's not about fund 1 or fund 2. And so how do you kind of convey that vision to LPs? than team building, because ultimately investing really is just a people's business. It's hiring people and then getting founders to like you and want to take your money. And then from a risk perspective, right, we're smaller. And so that's part of the issue for a lot of emerging managers. It's hard to get institutions because they don't write $5 million checks oftentimes. You're early, right, from a diligence process, from a learnings perspective, and then track record, right? I think the three key areas most LPs tell me they focus on is team strategy and track record, right? And when you're an emerging manager, you have no track record. So really people are betting on you are the right team for that strategy at this moment in time. So those are just some things I think GPs should just keep in mind when they're thinking through, especially emerging managers, how do you sell and convince LPs? Because you're not going to have the track record. You're going to be early. You're probably going to be smaller than they would like to go. And so you got to have these other things to get them to kind of outweigh that risk, because you do have risk and you have to, you know, kind of assume that risk and know that you have it and be upfront about it with LPs as well. So I thought that was like really
there's not a perfect fund or firm, right? It just doesn't exist, right? But you do have to convey your story, right? And also convey the value you will add to that relationship. And I think that's important over time, because, you know, it's never a yes or no to Harlem. It's always, it's Harlem relative to everyone else we're talking to. You know, that, from an allocator seat, sometimes I think some groups we have to, you know, give discouraging news to and say, you know, we're not going to make it on this fundraise. Let's stay in touch. You know, it's not always just yes or no to Harlem. It's yes, it's relative to everything else we're evaluating and kind of priorities in the portfolio, both from a bottom-up perspective and a top-down perspective, which you mentioned earlier. From an allocation standpoint, you know, our venture growth equity buckets have grown dramatically this year. So that's something to keep in mind as well.
Yeah, my number one past reason for founders today is opportunity costs, right? Like oftentimes we're on partner meetings and, right, this is a great deal, good founder, good market, good business. You know, we're targeting 12 to 15 deals a year. And it's really, is this a 1 in 15 deal? Right. And like usually, you know, when we pass, it's like it's a 1 in 30 or 1 in 50. We see 3,000 deals a year. So if you're 1 in 30, you're still top 1%, but you're not 1 in 15. And that's just a really something really hard to convey to founders. Like you hit all these things, but we just have other opportunity costs. And so I can imagine the same is true for you guys, and it makes a lot of sense. So I guess lastly here, wrapping up, right? Like any advice for emerging managers, any thoughts on like how emerging managers think about just raising this market?
You know, I think just going back to articulate kind of your strategy, clearly communicate kind of your vision, what you want to do, where you want to be, and just show focus. You know, the other thing I would mention as well is how does the strategy and team make the institution you're pitching to, how does it make their portfolio better, or how does it differentiate maybe from others that you may be competing against? That's always helpful. You know, how compelling is that answer? And for us, as we were evaluating Harlem, it was pretty compelling, right? There were lots of things about Harlem that could have gone wrong. But the upside was far greater than the downside, and so we got to the finish line there with the investment in the partnership, and like I said, there's not a perfect fund or firm, and as allocators we know that you're evolving, and you know you're the firm you are when you're raising fund one is not going to be the firm you are when you're at fund three or four. We realize that, but you have to give us the vision and where you think you'll end up. And what's that compelling value add? And that's something that we do look for as we're talking to kind of early stage managers. The other thing is, you know, part of our due diligence and sourcing is, as you can imagine, just talking to other people doing the same thing. We are allocating to the space and looking for great early stage partners. But we also participate in a lot of emerging manager conferences. And so we do try to have a lot of conversations. And if you're not participating in some of those, I would suggest getting out there and try to have as many conversations as you can. And I realize that your time is stretched from trying to make investments, but you know, it always helps to have kind of in-person conversations versus just cold emails. We get lots and lots of emails. So
that's a tough one. I think the key word from this episode is vision and conveying that vision through your story. I heard that word multiple times. So managers, get your vision story ready. But no, David, this is super helpful. Really appreciate your time. Appreciate you being a supporter of the firm. on your insight today. I think this would be massively beneficial for our listeners. So thanks again for your time.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you.